thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Java with Josh. I'm your host, legislator Josh Lafazan. Today we have a really exciting show with the managing partner of Hartman Capital, Felix Hartman, joining us. As we say every week, having big dreams is common, but figuring out how to achieve those dreams is rare. On this show, we interview some truly incredible people to share their journeys to success and give you the tools to reach your dreams. So grab your cup of Java and let's go. Felix, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, man, it's been a while. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I got to tell you, unfortunately, this is audio only because I'd love our listeners to see. You got the flow going. You got, you know, the work casual. You looking great. Moving to Miami soon, and we're going to talk about that. You got a glow on. But what I wanted, it's really incredible. I've known you for so many years now, and we were just talking, you know, before I introduce you, to watch your journey and to see you kind of really blow up. You said something off camera. You said, "It's years in the making of quiet work." And I just wanted to ask you about that before I introduce you, because I thought that was so profound.
Yeah. I mean, we've known each other since 2015 now. It's been 6 years. And, you know, like you said, it seems like I'm blowing up, and I hate to say those words coming out of my mouth, but I'll take them coming from your mouth. You know, there's a lot of like compounding that is happening now, but that took years of setting up, right? There's a lot of like, there's so much infrastructure that I've built specifically over the last 3 years where I wouldn't be able to, you know, see the certain growth that are happening now if I hadn't spent the time first setting up the infrastructure. And that was a very thankless time, very thankless, you know, like years in a way, where, you know, for many times there was more expenditures than income, because, you know, before you can make money of a fund, you first have to set up a fund. Before, you know, you have a personal brand, you first have to build relationships. There's many, many moving parts that went into what's unfolding now. And it takes a lot of work and some foresight, you know?
Well, every guest I have, I write down a little tidbit of what they give me. And I love that in terms of years of quiet work. It's almost like the overnight success, you know, 10 years in the making. So I'm just so proud of you. And for our listeners who are meeting you for the first time, I want to properly introduce you, because, you know, you're an amazing guy. Felix Hartman is the managing partner of Hartman Capital, where he runs one of the world's first multi-strategy crypto asset hedge funds. Felix's focus and expertise is in the realm of digital assets, has led him to advise billion-dollar merchant banks, G8 nations, as well as made him one of the first lecturers on the topic of Bitcoin and blockchain at several universities. Felix sits on the board of Enzyme and Octus, two publicly traded decentralized finance networks. And outside the realm of decentralization, Felix is a futurist at heart and author of the Dragon Award-nominated dystopian fiction novel, Dark Age. You do so much, but let's jump right in. And this is really my first question, because for so many of our listeners, that, you know, they're fascinated by crypto, but so many don't really understand it. So, you know, I want to jump in and say, first and foremost, what is Hartman Capital?
Somewhat limited about what I can say, but because of legalities, but we are an investment management firm that focuses specifically on crypto assets.
Okay, and that jumps into my second question, which I think you could hopefully expand on, is, you know, how did you get started in crypto? You know, because it's the hot buzz now, but you've been doing this for years. How did you get started?
Yeah, so first I started as a trader. I was a trader already back in 2012. You might remember when we first met back in 2015. Back then I was trading, you know, equities and derivatives. And then the turning point came where I was already analyzing Bitcoin, you know, from the charts and whatnot back in 2014 for friends. But what really did it for me was in 2016, I took a quick break from trading. I was on a hiatus while I became CEO of Funthis, which was a startup I ran. You also remember that chapter of my life.
Of course.
And Funthis was the first crowdfunding platform to integrate with both Coinbase and BitPay, where we wanted to accept Bitcoin as a form of payment, so to say. And what that did for me is it put Bitcoin front and center on my radar, because I was emailing back and forth these companies. And what I realized, what I noticed is that from, you know, 2016 is when this roughly happened. And from, like, let's say mid 2016 to early 2017, I saw Ethereum go from like $2 to $4 to maybe $50, which was already mind boggling. And then the trader in me woke up and said, "Hey, you know, you've been trading at that point already for like 5 years, 6 years. why don't you go all in on this? Because essentially I said, you know what, the startup had its own struggles. I had two other co-founders, they were butting heads. And at the same time, I saw this huge opportunity in crypto, because both from a price action perspective as a trader, but also the more I studied it, the more I really understood of like what it's really about and what it could do. I was like, we're at the very, very beginning still. It's so early. So I said, you know what, let me go all in on this. And of course, whoever went all in on crypto in early 2017 did rather well. But beyond, you know, good timing, I also traded the markets very effectively. And, you know, I outperformed Bitcoin by perhaps like 20, 30, 40, 60X. It was a large amount, depending on where you start tracking that. And that led to people saying, hey, why don't you trade for me? And at that time, I was still like 21 years old. I had no clue. I was like, hey, I would love to, but that sounds risky, like me taking other people's money. And it all culminated in one evening where one of my clients that I was consulting for invited me out for dinner and said, hey, why don't we give you like $10 million to start with? And I tried really hard to not let my jaw drop. You know, I was just like, I was like, Mr. Cool. I was like, act cool. I'm like, yeah, we can do that. The moment I go out, I'm like having like mini dances, and I'm like, okay, how do I actually do that though? So the next morning I call up, I Google how to start a hedge fund, and I find like, you know, three law firms, and I call them all up and getting my free 30-minute consultations. One of them I liked, and I said, all right, we're doing this. And I wired him, you know, like $20K to get started. I was like, well, we're setting up this hedge fund, and then the rest is history, I guess.
I mean, millions of dollars. I'm almost speechless in terms of millions of dollars. Well, what I want to ask you, you know, because this wasn't on my list of questions, but it's a question I have for you now. You believed you could do that. That was a Herculean effort to get it started. Where do you get the confidence in yourself that you could pull that off? Where does that confidence come from?
That's a fantastic question. I think confidence is something that is built over the long haul, where every single small feat that you conquer, it adds a little bit of substance to your confidence, right? So like the confidence I have now is leagues different than the confidence I had in 2017, 2018. You know, I think 2017, 2018, there was still some form of, and we all have that in the early stages, some form of like imposter syndrome, some form of, you know, like fake it till you make it perhaps. Cause you know, at the time I was still really young, and I'm still young, but at least now I have a much different sense of confidence because I have been through so many crazy market environments. I've been through the 60% Bitcoin crash in a single day in March. I've been through one of the most brutal bear markets. So the fact, and I always make this comparison of the market is like riding a ship into the storm almost, you know? And like, I've survived so many different, you know, moments where I know based on my own history, like you've seen worse, you know how to handle these situations. Even if worse comes to worst, you've been here before. So I think confidence is merely a culmination of experiences, really.
Well, I think that's a great answer. And you know, the more experience you get, the more success you have, the more confidence you build. And speaking of confidence, well, we've seen literally millions of young people during the pandemic open up a Robinhood account, open up a Stash account, invest. It seems like everyone on Twitter believes that they're a successful trader. But I want, you know, so many of them have written in, Josh, you know, I have $1,000, I want to invest it. Josh, I don't know what to do with my money. So let's take it from the beginning. And you touched on it. What is cryptocurrency, and can you explain it for somebody who they've just heard of Bitcoin but they don't really understand it?
Yeah, 100%. And it's funny because the very first word needs some redefinition. Back in 2017, cryptocurrency became popular under Bitcoin first, right? Bitcoin was the first major, you know, digital asset. I like to call them digital assets, because very few of them are actually trying to be currencies, right? So if we take the big picture of all the things that people trade under the title cryptocurrency, really what it is, it's assets of the digital world, okay? So Bitcoin is digital money, okay? Ethereum is essentially, you know, digital oil that you use to drive down the roads of the new internet, right? And then there are other vehicles that are like digital shares in digital companies, or digital networks, really. So the big innovation behind digital assets, you know, which again is a different name for cryptocurrencies because very few of them are actual currencies, is this new level of the internet, right? The internet was the biggest innovation of the 2000s, where the biggest companies in the world, Amazon was, you know, it's the biggest store without any product, at least initially. Netflix was the biggest, you know, movie company without any movies initially. Facebook was the biggest content producer without any content itself, right? Uber was the biggest taxi company without any taxis. And what digital assets do is they spread that even further to every single category out there. And to take it one step further, the problem that we've seen with these big companies like Amazon, Netflix, et cetera, is they started as David, but they've become Goliath, where they become the new middleman. So what all these decentralized networks are trying to accomplish is to create middleman-free systems. And Bitcoin did that for money. You can now transfer money between people without any middlemen. Now expand that to everything else in the world. There's now decentralized exchanges without any exchange, like a Robinhood, without Robinhood taking money in the middle, right? It's just a network. There's decentralized lending, like a Lending Club, but without Lending Club taking cut in the middle. Every single thing that can exist in the real world is now existing decentralized, where it is much more free and peer-to-peer. That was a long answer and probably way too complicated for beginners, but the bottom line is try to invest in things that decentralize real services that are one single verb, like decentralized lending, decentralized exchanging, decentralized options, decentralized money. It should be one Lego piece to the overall puzzle that is the world.
Well, I thought it was a great description. And the next question, of course, is because, you know, obviously there's way more than Bitcoin, but everyone is talking about Bitcoin. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, the epic rise of Bitcoin and where you, you know, as an observer, see this going? We have people who are, you know, skeptics, like some of my friends who are saying, you know, Bitcoin is over. And I have people I keep reading on the internet that say Bitcoin's going to reach $400,000.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, Bitcoin is the hardest, you know, non-sovereign money out there in the world, or self-sovereign, really, meaning it's not backed by any country. It is global. It is borderless. It cannot be censored. It cannot be changed, meaning it's mutable. And it's peer-to-peer. So it's, in my eyes, the best form of money that exists in the world because it's also non-inflationary, or at least it has a fixed supply schedule. So it's a money that the world has never seen, really, because most of the monies in the world so far, and they're really more currencies, are ruled by governments. And as we saw this year, 2020, last year, we printed 25% of the M2 money supply in a single year, which is mind-boggling. 25% of the entire money supply in a single year. We printed more money in a single week in March than existed before 2008, right? So that is just like mind-bending. And to take it further, you know, even back in the day of the, you know, the kings and Rome and everywhere, even gold has its weaknesses. You know, people would just, kings would simply melt down gold and mix in cheap copper or something and make more money out of it. Because, you know, how do you really know if you get pure gold? You have to go to like a testing site. You like roll it out until you know, okay, it's actually pure. It doesn't break, which is a pain in the butt. You know, meanwhile, with Bitcoin, if you send me Bitcoin to my wallet, I know it's real. It's not a fake Bitcoin, because you can't send a fake Bitcoin to another Bitcoin wallet. You know, it's like pretty much only a real one goes in there, right? Because it's on the actual blockchain, it's on the actual protocol. So you don't have the issue of counterfeit money. You don't have the issue of a government or a central body printing or inflating money. You don't have the issue of, you know, a government telling you you can't do something. Right. And the problem is because people might say, well, it's good that the government prevents people from, you know, spending money in certain ways because, you know, you work in government, you know, there's certain activities that are illegal, but there's also legal activities that are prohibited by banks. For example, in California and certain states, cannabis is legal. Right. Meanwhile, a lot of banks won't work with cannabis companies. Or the adult industry. Look, you don't have to like it. You could think it's like a vice. It could be bad. But at the end of the day, it's a legal industry and most banks won't touch it. Or they would even like have incredible surcharges, et cetera. So, and even a step further, maybe, yes, we have the luxury. We have the amazing ability to live in a free country like the United States. But there's many, many countries out there that don't, right? So imagine you live in an authoritarian country where they can simply They can wipe you out of the financial system, seizing your assets, blocking you from doing anything like that. So that was a long fundamental answer to that question. But the bottom line is, because it is such an amazing form of money, it's not going to go away. There's many use cases. Even if it didn't succeed in the US, there's hundreds of other countries out there that need this type of money. And that's why I think long-term in our lifetime, we will see Bitcoin in the millions. Will it be volatile until then? Sure. Will it have pullbacks that, you know, make it lose 40% of its money value? Sure. But everybody should own some Bitcoin because it is going to be the hardest asset in the world.
I appreciate, you know, it's I always knew, you know, Felix knows his stuff, but I appreciate your ability to summarize that to the layperson, which is where I'm going to take my next question. People write in, Josh, I have $500, I have $1,000, I don't have a lot of money, but I'd like to invest it, which is incredible to get young people starting and investing early. What would your advice be to those young kids? How, you know, how to get started, or quite frankly, adults. Josh, I have $2,000 to play with. You know, what is your advice to some of those small dollar folks who want to get involved in investing?
Yeah, I would say the very first thing, and even though, like, I personally, with the fund, for example, we hardly even trade Bitcoin or Ethereum anymore because we are much more targeted on smaller tokens. But for the average holder, or like if I had, let's say, I was going to say if I had a girlfriend, or like if I had a child, or if I had, you know, whatever, my family, I would tell them, that was funny. I would tell them, hey, just hold Bitcoin and Ethereum. You know, maybe a 70% Bitcoin, 30% Ethereum split, but keep it simple because look, unfortunately, every single time I talk to retail investors, they are investing into some random, you know, altcoins out there that I'm not even looking at because they're pretty much worthless, but somehow, because guess what? Which kind of tokens do people hear about the most? The ones with the biggest marketing budget. Do quality products market a lot? No. They spend their money on product and development, right? So the good projects that actually spend money on product and development, they usually get overseen. That's what I look for. But then the project everybody hears about is usually we call them shit coins, you know, that have high marketing budgets and nothing behind it. So to protect retail investors, I always say, stay away from most alts, just invest in Bitcoin and Ethereum, maybe a 50-50 split, maybe a 70-30 split. If you're super risk averse, then, you know, you can do 100% Bitcoin and you should be fine, right? But fully understand that there are pullbacks. So for example, in the last bull market in 2017, Bitcoin pulled back 40%, not once, not twice, not three times, eight times. It pulled back 40% eight times. So you have to ask yourself, if you are the person that says, I'm going to throw $2,000 into this, what will you do when this is all of a sudden worth like $1,200? Are you freaking out and are you selling or are you holding? If the answer isn't holding, then you should probably invest a little bit less, right? And equally, also ask yourself the opposite. What if tomorrow Bitcoin is worth $50,000? Are you all of a sudden going to buy more? Well, if the answer is yes, then you should probably buy it now instead. And I had this argument a lot of times with people and especially my investors over the last 2 years where I said, look, I sent an avalanche of messages out when Bitcoin broke 12,000 because that was a very important like technical moment in the Q4, which was like October, where I said, guys, I don't do this a lot. I rarely hit you up unless it's a really good time to buy. And I said, guys, now this is a really big shift because this was like a 3-year breakout. If you want to allocate, you better do it now because it's only going to get more expensive later on, right? Some did. I'm proud of them, but there's also many that didn't. And guess what they're doing now? Now they're buying at 4 times the price, right? Because I've always made this point that I think most people are under allocated because sometimes even very wealthy people think that a 1% allocation to Bitcoin is a lot. They think, wow, that's a lot because it's high risk. But then guess what? Once it becomes the hottest thing everybody talks about, now they're thinking, well, why don't I put 20% of my wealth into it? You might as well start with a little bit more and then not, you know, add it down the road. Because what I did a seminar tour in Europe about the subject last year. And I told them, this was when Bitcoin was worth like $7,000. And I told them, hey, the next 200 days, this was like 2019, the next 200 days is your one chance to build as much as you can so that when the bull market finally starts, you can take some profits off the table, right? What most people do is the opposite. They ignored it when it was cheap, and now they're starting to buy in. And guess what? When Bitcoin is $200,000, we will read stories again of how people are mortgaging their houses to buy Bitcoin. And that's a losing strategy. Ultimately, I don't want anybody to use debt to buy anything in the first place. But also, just, you know, put some planning into it and dollar cost average over time.
And what does that mean by dollar cost average? Because, you know, I learned that the other day, but I'm hoping you can explain that to our listeners. Because sometimes people say, I have 10,000, you know, sayonara. It does not mean that yet.
So funny story. In October, it was New Year, it was Halloween. I was with a friend, and he has been, making fun of Bitcoin for like the last 3 years. And then I think in October, perhaps Bitcoin was worth like $15,000, or it was maybe $14,000, And he told me, "Oh, I'm going to wait to buy Bitcoin when it drops back to $12,000." And I told him that you should better just dollar cost average. Okay. So what he tried to do was time the market, right? That you have two choices. Either time the market, we say, this is the bottom, this is when I buy, this is the top, this is when I say, oh, you can dollar cost average. What dollar cost averaging means is that instead of him waiting for 12,000, which by the way, never happened, all he could do was say, hey, I want to buy, let's say, $2,000 worth of Bitcoin. Instead of me buying those $2,000 all at once, what if I buy perhaps $100 every single day for the next 20 days, or perhaps I buy $500 every month for the next 4 months. The idea behind it is that you portion your investment amount into smaller pieces. That way, the timing doesn't matter as much, right? So if you bought your $500 today, and then next month the market crashes, you'll be like, damn, I wish I hadn't bought that high. But more of you will be like, awesome, I have another chance to buy a little bit cheaper with my next installment of $500. All of a sudden, you cut those emotions out, because it doesn't really matter if the market goes up or down, because if it goes down, great buying opportunity. If it goes up, awesome, you made money, right? It's kind of like a win-win. And I think that's the easiest way for passive investors to really cut out those emotions, not worry about what the market does next, but rather focus on building a position, building an allocation.
You see, and for so many of those passive investors like me, where you're just kind of figuring it out, for those real intense investors, so many of them are picking up and moving to Miami. So I want to talk about this in terms of, you look happy. How did this happen? When did this happen? You know, was the mayor involved?
Yeah, shout out to Francis. He's been very responsive. Mayor Suarez from Miami. Obviously, he's been just on a tear. You know, reaching out to all kinds of people in tech and finance and crypto. And one day I either tweeted him or I sent him a DM, and he's been super responsive. And we've had a couple back and forth since. I even texted him once, or I DM'd him once. It was like this week, where I said, you know, we're about to move and we're going to hire a couple new full-timers. He said, oh, let me know when you have like the job postings. I'll make an announcement. I'm like, this is so awesome. You know, too many times I think government feels like you're playing against the government, when really it should be like this supportive back and forth, where like, hey, I come to your city, I create jobs, you help me find the best people, we grow together, which I love. I think the move is inspired for multiple reasons here, to put it less simply. But, you know, some of those reasons include, and we have most cities, I'm personally a libertarian, so I believe in some form of freedoms. There's been too many cities that have completely shut everything down. And I understand you have to take precautions to protect people. But at the same time, I've seen it hurt small businesses the most. One of my hairdressers, she got fined $10,000, believe it or not, for operating. And you know, we're all wearing masks. There's like one person in the salon at a time. And it's just like, those are, you know, it's those people's livelihoods. And that kind of stuff really rubs me the wrong way, where it's now playing the opposite, where I say, hey, that's not a government I want to support. I think that's going too far. So I liked how Miami's handled it. Ultimately, I still see masks on the streets. Ultimately, if people want to stay home, they can stay home. There's lots of delivery services. But for, you know, a lot of people, you know, it's no longer a two-week lockup, but rather it's a multi-year thing. It started to turn to a multi-year venture, where it's people's futures. So on one hand, it's a politically ideologically, I align more with Florida stance. I think Miami's doing a good job. I see a lot of talent move to Miami. There's, I think Goldman decided to move there. It was either Blackstone or BlackRock is moving to Miami. A lot of crypto is moving to Miami finance. So there's a lot of motion there. So from a networking perspective, it's a win for me. I think from a lifestyle, it's the most free, the most open. Of course, taxes play a role too. So there's multiple factors, but I think Miami has a lot to offer. And Austin was a consideration too. For me, it was like Austin or Miami. Ultimately, Miami won over. They've got more friendly securities laws and several other pieces that to the puzzle that where I said, hey, this is going to be the move. Plus, it's EST time zone. It's close to Europe. I have family in Europe. So it's always been complicated having 9-hour time difference, whereas 6 hours is much more friendly.
And it leads into my next question. And it's basically, I could see you doing so much in life. I could see you running the Fed. I could see you,
Burn that thing down on the first day.
I could see you being the next Bobby Axelrod from Billions. I could see you doing so much. What is the next 10, 15 years look like for you?
Well, I think for the next 10 years, I'll certainly be committed to the digital asset space. I think it's the most potent industry in the world right now. There's a lot of big issues, and sometimes people misunderstand me when I say this. There's a lot of important tasks to be solved, a lot of important things that the world needs. But at the heart of it all, I think, is decentralization. I took a lot of time over the past 4 years. And in 2016, I kind of made my life vision for the next 50 years. And I took a lot of time thinking about, where's the future heading in the next few years? And what it all boiled down to is that almost every single issue the world is facing comes down to centralization, right? Whether it's the erosion of our privacy because of big tech, right? You can fix that by not having all our data in the hands of big tech, which is a form of decentralizing social media, for example. Or whether it's the over-leveraging, the things that we saw in the 2008 financial crisis. Again, it's an issue of centralization by a few banks having too much control over the financial system and a lack of transparency. Nearly every single issue and the wealth, the rich poor gaps, the wealth gaps, almost everything can be brought back to issues of centralization. So I've really made my mission to say, hey, decentralization is the most powerful force for good, really, that we have right now. And it can improve almost any industry, right? So I think for the next 10 years, I'll easily be busy navigating the digital asset markets. I do that via fund because I think as a fund, in this world, capital speaks the loudest, right? So with money, I can guide the right projects. I can guide the right networks to become successful. And I take an active role too. As you said, I'm on a few boards, and I also take a very active approach to our investing where I work with the teams. Because of token ownership, I have voting rights, so I can vote on the future of some of these protocols and make sure that we go the right direction. That's the next 10 years for me. After that, I definitely see myself expand in other technologies, whether that's AI, virtual reality, transhumanism, just always on the kind of technologies that will affect the future of the species the most. Because ultimately, I think people underestimate what the world will look like in 2050. We very much are very caught up in 2020. We're very much caught up in, the Trump era and COVID. And to me, when you zoom out, it's a lot of drama because we're not really aware yet of what does a world look like. Well, let's say 80% of the people are unemployed because of automation. What does a world look like where AI has more, let's call it, mental capability than humans do, right? When we have AGI, what does the world look like where, all of a sudden, when I said virtual reality, current states of virtual reality are things like TV and your computer and social media. It's virtual reality, but it's bad UI UX, if I want to keep it simple, right? As virtual reality improves and it becomes more immersive, all of a sudden, what if you have those 80% unemployed people spent most of their time in virtual reality, almost using virtual reality as a drug? What does a world like that look like? And also when virtual reality becomes so real to real life, how do we govern that? So to me, a lot of the stuff, like when people, and I had this sentiment a lot of times in 2017, 2018, when people acted like we were living in a dystopia. And I zoomed out and I said, "What? You guys don't know where we're heading." Right. So I think right now is like the most utopian things I've been. And sure, I have privilege. But at the same time, I think our biggest challenges as a culture, as a society, as a species, are still ahead. So my life's vision and mission simply has been to essentially empower myself, both economically, politically, and societally, so that I can be a force for good when that time comes, and make sure that these technologies are used for good and to help push us into a thriving future, rather lead us further down this road of corruption and dystopia, really.
And it leads me to my last question. You know, listening to you speak, you've grown so much in your understanding of really everything, but specifically in finance, you really are an eminent voice. And it's why I want to ask you, if you could speak to young Felix, what would be the biggest piece of advice that you would give him?
Young Felix. So really focus more to like young investors, right? Like if somebody's trying to like, you know, build a portfolio, make some money, right? Is that?
Direction. You know, well, Jay, you know, or any in life and investing, any, you know, the biggest piece of advice that you would give to young people?
Yeah, for sure. I think I could have, I'm on a good track, but I could have accelerated my road quite a bit, by perhaps 3 to 4 years, which compounds quite a bit. By on one hand, being more long-term oriented, right? So like I started my career more as a day trader, and like you can make good money day trading, but it does, when you have a small account, in my eyes, it's a little bit of a waste of time, because the reason being, if you have, let's say, when I made my account with best example, I did this for I wrote my market update a couple of days ago, and the very first stock I ever bought was Tesla, right? I only had $1,000 in my account. This is like back in 2013. Post stock split price, that was $28 a share, which means my investment of like $1,000 would today be worth $24,000, right? Now, I've made way more money than that with trading long-term. But if my perspective is that if the best way for a young investor to go forward is to first build your capital base, meaning the best thing Felix should have done at that time is invest in Tesla, go make some more money so you can add more to your portfolio. I talk to too many young people and they have no capital at all. Right. I think a lot of people, let's say age 20 to 25, 26, they're stuck in that 4-digit to low 5-digit range. And then when you go above that, maybe 25 to 35, maybe like, you know, 50K in savings, 75K in savings, because as a fund manager, I talk to people a lot about their finances. Plus you have debt, student debt and whatnot. I think the most important thing you can do for yourself to empower yourself. And when I say empower yourself, it's not about the expenditures, it's more about you being able to pursue your vision. Like when I talk about this crazy stuff I want to do with the future, I can only do that if I empower myself financially, right? So I would put any young investor out there to heart, you know, focus on building your capital base, right? Save and invest in long-term things. So like that's one thing I got right. You know, I invested in Tesla back in 2013. I invested in Bitcoin early. I invested into like a lot of these high growth things. But then instead of like, you know, being worried about, you know, catching like a swing here and there, just keep stacking until you get to the point where those trades can actually make you more money than you can make with a job. And that time comes where at this point, I would never go back to a job anymore, because I simply by trading like very little bit, I can make more than I could hope to make with a job. And it's not, I'm very different from most people, especially like those influencers and whatnot, that are like, oh, it's about quitting your job, escape the 9-to-5, live your dream, and like sleep on a beach or whatever. No, for me, this empowerment is really more about asking yourself, like, what is it that you actually want to do in this life, in this world? Because whether it's running for office, running a campaign takes money, right? I wrote a book, publishing a book and like, you know, getting a good editor and all that stuff, it takes money. Whether you want to do a charity, it takes money. So at the end of the day, and I want you to keep those goals in mind when you make those sacrifices. Like you say, hey, you know what? I'm not going to get a fancy car. One of the biggest mistakes I made early on, I got myself a Mercedes. I was like, my first car was a very nice flashy Mercedes because I made some money with trading, when in reality, that was, I think, over 3 years, like, you know, $30,000. Imagine I put those $30,000 into Bitcoin in 2015, right? So like, yeah, it felt great at the time, but looking back, it's much, much smarter to like defer your material dreams or goals so that you can pursue the actual meaningful dreams later. Because the point will come when you get to actually pursue your meaningful dreams, when the material ones don't matter anymore, right? I'm still eating pasta out of a coffee mug. I'm still eating rice and beans because like, it doesn't mean anything to me, because I think it's just, it serves the purpose of keeping you fed. By the end of the day, like I make money so that I can, you know, whether it's like investing into startups and empowering young entrepreneurs, or, you know, helping push the technologies that the world needs to see. So I think if you're 18 right now, if you're 20 or whatever, take a deeper look at what actually drives you. Take a deeper look at like what you're actually wanting to make money for, and ask yourself, if I had, you know, millions today and you already spent your 6 months partying and like having nice cars and all that stuff, what's next? Are you really going to do that for 50 years? And then just focus on that, focus on building that so that you actually get the chance, because unfortunately, most people don't get the chance to pursue their visions and their dreams because they're caught in the hamster wheel. So put that vision first beyond everything, especially when you're young.
I love that. I love the fact that, you know, we're going to have you back on the show because I'm excited to see where you go. I think your potential is limitless, and I'm grateful for your friendship, for your advice, for your ability to state your opinion matter-of-factly, and for the mentorship you have of young people. We will see you back soon. Enjoy the sunshine in Miami, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Have a good one. Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. And thank you to Felix Hartman for an amazing conversation. Make sure to click subscribe to our podcast and check us out on Instagram and Facebook for videos and bonus features. I'd also love to hear your questions and comments. Feel free to shoot me an email at josh@joshlafazan.com. I'm legislator Josh Lafazan. And thanks for joining us for Java with Josh.